And local. Part 3. Vegetarian braided seal intestines. Taiga and Clifton Mosquito are sitting at a large birchwood table with a cadre of local chefs after hours in a dark restaurant filled with obviously fake animal heads completely covering the walls all around them like the papier-mâché hunting trophy room of a flamboyant ogre. They are all smoking stinky Chinese cigarettes one of those chefs recently brought back from New Taipei City, drinking a local brew called Old Mudflat Stout from the Girdwood Brewery, and eating braided seal intestines in a wild mushroom and tomato sauce. Everyone ripping off pieces of crusty bread and dipping them, supping up pieces of intestine in deep brown mushroom. The intestines are braided around seal fat and cut to look about the size and shape of the mushrooms. They are lightly breaded and sautéed, making them almost indistinguishable from the actual mushrooms in the sauce. The dish is served family style in a large contemporary scad made by a local bowlsmith from a sizable piece of driftwood he fished out of the waters around Ketchikan. The edges are intricately carved to imitate mushrooms naturally growing from the wood, with little dwarves marching around them carrying bearded seal ghost piggyback. The scad was given to Taiga last summer and is one of his favorite things. In fact, he sings a version of My Favorite Things to himself with all the wrong lyrics every time he gets the scad out. "You are a fucking prick, Taiga," exclaimed one of the chefs in a state of pure joy. "Fuck you, Taiga," a rotund chef in a culinary ecstasy squirted sternly from a full mouth. Another chef is chewing with her eyes closed, smiling. "I want to slap your stupid fucking face, Tai." "The fuck, dude?" Clifton jumps in. "This stuff really is spectacular." "This vegan?" The most academically inclined, and coincidentally, the most inebriated chef, funneling the conversation with his adamant skepticism as he is pulling deep on his headache-smoked cigarette and leaning back in his chair, making loud wooden squeaking noises out of place in this evil paper fantasy trophy galleria. "Nah, we can't get them funny gusses to taste like that. Would be bad if we even want that," Taiga asks with a little evil smile on his lip, puckering a bit, breathing in. Winking at his friend, he continued, "Beats Crisco and Veggie-All, though, right? And it's fucking awesome, you know." One of the chefs, with a mouthful of intestines, asked Taiga, Dude, are you going to call it vegan braided seal intestines, or that native name you said?" Taiga started back at him, giggling. "I wanted to call it vegan offal, so peeps would think I was saying something else. Ha ha! But it's both. Like everything else, dude, we always say both. Some motherfucker's going to buy vegan muktuk or vegetarian moose nose jelly." "You guys make moose nose jelly?" No, I was just saying, I don't know if a funny sounding name can make much of a difference, right? People are either going to be buying it because they want to touch a fire, or they act like they're playing with fire. Really, it's just a bunch of cold mushrooms just sprouted up overnight. You ain't drinking blood, you ain't drinking blood, you know what I mean? Sitting in the fuck it, vegetarian braided seal intestines. Another excited chef raising a pint of mostly drunk dark black beer, which was soon lost to an accomplished and edified digestive tract. They all raised and toasted, getting back to their disgusting cigarettes and delicious handcrafted beers, then dipping the fresh-baked bread into the aromatic seal and mushroom, which reminded some of the chefs of an old Italian dish and tomato baked mixed with a rich French country mushroom dish. This food was typical of the way cuisine was evolving in Anchorage, sort of functioning as a hub for international and hyper-local foodstuffs. Chefs were creating exceptionally creative dishes and preparation methods based on fusions between Old World Alaskan and a global gourmet, which critics began referring to as Haute Beringian. Things like sous vide gooey duck and a muskox milk bechamel with smoked black seaweed nests with Yukon potato eggs, or Alaska fried sea duck waffle tacos with a birch syrup hot sauce reduction. And the after-hours food scene got even more precocious and daring with things like luau seal lung with spruce-tipped polar aspic or minced walrus meat pies with fiery gudeg foam and highbush blueberries. There had been a revival in locally sourced food all over the world, but Alaska was in an odd spot because of all the rich history and traditions of subsistence living and the fact that available farmland for growing traditional European-American-style crops was only manageable in a small sliver of the Matanuska Valley, just north of Anchorage. It couldn't yield the quantity or quality of produce that would sustain a locavore scene. But luckily, a bigger part of the locavore thing was eating what was around and developing a cuisine based on what is available, eating with the seasons. Farms out of Wasilla, Butte, Big Lake, and Palmer could yield huge cabbages and lettuces in the summer months, I had to move everything into a greenhouse system come winter, and the long dark months weren't kind to plants. The fact that the Anchorage Bowl sat in the middle of a rather sizable wilderness, surrounded by Cook Inlet to the west and the Chugach Forest to the east, with the Kenai to its south, stood to reason that the sourcing of the forests and hills was more in order. So a renewed interest in wild Alaskan herbs, berries, and roots developed, as well as more people looking at sustainable fishing and hunting. Alaskans from the villages to the cities have always enjoyed the seasonal subsistence harvest. City dwellers make the trek down to the Kenai Peninsula every year to dip net reds. Moose and salmon were the most readily available and legal for subsistence harvest to the average Anchorageite, with a peaked look at halibut and seaweed. Inevitably, people in Anchorage wanted more than the berry pickers and seaweed gatherers could collect, prepare, and distribute out of the small towns. They wanted to go to the store and buy things like ooligan grease, watermelon berry paste, muir eggs, alpine sweet vetch, and dried cow parsnip. Native chefs from Kotzebue, Point Hope, or Barrow would come into Anchorage with tundra herbs or sea mammal meats. The tundra herbs and plants, for the most part, were fine to sell, but it's against the law to sell seal oil or whale meat within the Anchorage borough. It had to be given away as a present, and if you wanted to serve it in a restaurant, it had to be after hours, free of charge. So although it is pretty common to have seal oil on the family table, it wasn't something readily available at the store. The mosquitoes would get seal oil from a cousin who went on an annual seal hunt out of Barrow and would leave a cooler full of oil, meat, and sometimes fish whenever he flew through Anchorage. They'd also get it through the consortium initiative, where both parents still worked, from people coming in and out of the villages from time to time. Sunshine was 3 years old the first time he went out with his family to dip net, and he loved it before he even knew what it really was. He had grown up eating smoked salmon at least 4 times a week, and dried whitefish every Sunday. His brothers and father filled his brain with fishing stories, morning, noon, and night. He would beg his father to tell him about the one time he had to wrestle a salmon from a sea lion that was trying to steal it from his net. When the family went dip netting, Clifton held little Sunshine on his shoulders so he could hold the net himself for the first time. Then he would drag the struggling salmon up to the beach together where it would be quickly dispatched. Sunshine happily took the job of bonker, whacking every salmon that came out of the water before its gills were cut, letting them bleed out into the sand and keep the meat fresh. The memory of his first time bonking a salmon is one of his oldest and fondest, which he would go to in his mind during the long year he spent in a waiting room on another planet, wishing he could bonk the head of whatever was keeping him there. Did they even have heads? Just look like a big sponge meatball with float bladders. Vegan seal oil was the first thing Taiga Mosquito attempted of his vegetarian Alaskan food enterprise. It was almost a joke. He was developing more as a culinary statement. Gusick medicine, he would call it. The name of his food company was Funny Gusick Foodstuffs. Gusick is the Yupik word for non-natives, probably taken from a pidgin for Cossack. Villages in eastern Alaska, Gusick food means what non-natives eat, and it can be a little mean-sounding. He went through several versions before something resembling the real thing was achieved. It was a mix of fermented soy and an edible protist, which is a species of blue algae. He had been testing out. The one thing it lacked was the punch real seal oil had, that rush of adrenaline that could keep you warm all day. The food alternative tasted correct on the plate and was true to the extreme greasiness of the Nikapik, a broad slang term for real food or Eskimo food. But it didn't satiate the way seal oil does. Taiga will perfect a recipe using mostly locally sourced seaweed and fungus, configured into bowhead-flavored muktuk, skin, blubber, and all. He was featured in a few foodie blogs and several magazines. A local television station did a piece on him. A few tourists even made their way to Anchorage from the ferries down south to try the whale meat alternative. Eventually, a couple gourmet markets in Seattle started selling it as well, with a moderate amount of success. The hope was that they could break into the Scandinavian markets, the only Arctic peoples that still seem to have an unending amount of money, big populations, and already liked eating seal meat. The muktuk was sold as is, so that people could eat it frozen or chop it up, bread it, and fry it. The textures were all accurate, too, gummy or chewy where appropriate and melt in your mouth good. Most people who bought vegan muktuk would eat it frozen in the traditional way, shaving off thin slices or little chunks. There was a pickled version of the product as well, packaged up like jarred herring. This was more for the access to the Scandinavian markets. He was looking to work with some scientists and molecular gastronomy-focused chefs to work with lab meats. Artificially raised lab meat could be grown in basements in the winter in Alaska at the cost of electricity, with super sterile conditions and grown to suit. Want a blueberry whale bit? Up the blubber genes, want some woolly mammoth? Just plug in the genomic sequence and put it in a culture bath and whirl it up, Tago went on to say. Someone would pull the ethics card and point or invoke God. What you want to go and play God for? His food come natural ain't good enough for you? This was a toothless argument Tiger had been in several times. Sometimes he would counter it with, if God made food so perfect, how come we eat it and let little bacteria turn into something our bodies can use? How come some of it has to be cooked or killed first? Or, you know, cooking is just a cultural thing. People cook food to make it easier to digest. Cooking is really just pre-digesting, breaking food down a little chemically before we eat it. That's why we react biologically to fancy cuisine. It's prepared, changing the natural caloric content of the food. It is stasis, status, nothing else. It's a leisure activity. Genetically modified or laboratory-constructed meat was something most people kept an aversion to. That is where most folks draw the line. Growing in edible mold in large vats, then mixed with egg protein, tastes just like chicken. That's totally acceptable as a meat alternative, but taking a genetic stem cell starter for chicken breasts and growing them on a sterile mesh is something out of a horror movie. Tag was known to get on a tear when talking about food culture. He'd say things like, I hate it when you see those anthropology books, things talking about agriculture, and they always say things, except the Inuit, they don't have that fucking bullshit. Seems like all cultures on the planet have a form of agriculture where they farm plants, except the Eskimo, they know farm good. I can name 100 tundra herbs, even more if we start talking seaweed and protists. They all say all cultures on Earth have some form of drug-induced magical thinking brought on by indigestion and local plants, except for them Eskimos, because it's just so fucking cold, ain't nothing gonna grow in the snow. Tell you what, even them dumb sons of bitches, they never heard of summer, maybe they never heard of magic mushrooms all over the Pacific Northwest, or in the midnight sun, but I know for certain they never tried seal oil at -20, because then, I know they wouldn't be talking like ignorant pricks. Pure adrenaline. Tell me who tells stories of hairy-handed boogeyman thinking about pure adrenaline magic. Ah, Ty. You know who I ran into the other night at Delaney Park? Uncle Brick. You remember him? Clifton was putting a cigarette out in the ashtray, blowing out smoke at the end. That old wizard with the tattoos? Yeah. The wizarding tattoos. That shit is too funny. Those tattoos. You remember? Anyway. Dude's living over at Delaney Park, not far from work. Clifton was trailing off and was getting quiet as people wanted to hear what was going on. Cliff? I didn't have a story, sorry. Just run into him. He's still batshit crazy, talking about all sorts of insane things. But he called my name out across the park. Clifton? That you, brother? That you eating a sandwich or something? Like it hasn't been years since we've seen each other. Actually, who's eating a sandwich, too? Not that he could tell from that far away. Clifton grabbed another piece of bread and dipped it into the sauce, getting a little piece of seal with it. Brick asked about sunshine. Sunshine? Come on. What? No shit. He just right out and asked if I know where sunshine is. I told him, he's still a kid. He's in school. Brick says, oh yeah, I keep forgetting what year it is. Can you believe that? Who's Uncle Brick? One of the other chefs asks. Taggart starts chuckling a little bit. Sorry, I'm laughing. It is really not funny. Brick is this guy that was around more when Cliff and I were kids, when Sunshine was a real little kid. Uncle Brick isn't really our uncle. He was married to our mom's cousin for a spell. That's when he was around. He can't remember what he did for a living, but he's legendary in the family because he got into a breakup fight with our mom's cousin one night, said he was a warlock or some shit, and he was needed on the other side to fight a great evil or something. He's taking off his clothes as they're fighting. He ends up walking in the snow in the middle of winter, ass naked, screaming about magic or something. All he had was this huge warehouse-sized bag of tortilla chips. He was eating out. He was arguing and eating. We heard this story from Mom's cousin 100 times. That motherfucker just chomping away. Crunch, 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 crunch. I'm the greatest wizard of the North. I must fight for the sake of my people. And that son of a bitch just walks right out into the snow, dropping tortilla chips everywhere. He is talking, out of the bag, out of his mouth, while he's eating and talking, blah, 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 blah. The last thing I see is this huge, dumbass dragon tattoo on his ass. For a couple of years, he was upset because it looked like Brick had wandered out and died because the body was never found. And he never showed up with any cops or in the hospital. Supposedly, he's really been homeless since that day. For the record, Brixton Verde did have what would appear to be, to the untrained eye, to be a tattoo of a dragon on his back. It was actually a limbless lizard, an actual animal, and not a fantasy creature. It was several times larger than they are in real life, and it was dressed up for Halloween as Falkor, the luck dragon from the Neverending Story. The written description in the actual surrealist novel by Indy, and not the Hollywood movie where they made him look like the dog. Rick liked Falkor because Falkor could sleep while flying, which is empirically awesome, and of which he would tell to anyone who cared, but literally, not one person ever cared when Brick told them about Falkor. It was an element of Brick's childhood that never cauterized or healed. Brick even referred to Falkor in the German when he spoke of him. "Falkor can sleep while he is flying, Dad!" "That's great, kid."